Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark.
Hey guys, welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. As you may have already noticed, this is not John Lasseter for this week. Nope, it's not. It's a new host, a brand new host forever. No, just this one episode. I'm covering for John. My name's Robert Lamb, L-A-M-B. And I'll be hosting this episode of Movies, Films, and Flicks. You might have known I've been on Movies, Films, and Flicks before, but never as a host. So this will be great. I'll get to be able to try to be John. But anyways,
what'd you do to John?
Well, right now he's tied to the floor and bound. He can't get out. I just told him I wanted to take over and see if I could, you know, basically impersonate him. And I think to a T, I sound exactly like John Lasseter.
So is he like bound and tied up and gagged under the table so like you can kick him periodically while you're recording?
No, he's bound, but just out of my foot length. But like I tease him every once in a while, making him think I can kick him. He's actually he can't listen to this either. I got his ears plugged up, and he can't see.
Bind and gag him, but you will only taunt him about actually kicking him.
And Lasseter actually went out of his way to watch both of these movies for this episode.
Oh, he was so excited to do it. And I was like, oh yeah, man, go in the room and start recording. And then right after that, conked him on the head, and now he's on the floor tied up.
I love a good movie bonk to the head that knocks people unconscious. Like, I was watching Monty Python, The Holy Grail, when those knights were singing in the castle, and this, like, little peasant gets bonked on the head with a mace. Like, I love a good bonk on the head. Like,
there's not enough bonks.
You know, yeah, exactly. Like, I love a good head bonk.
There's nothing like a good head bonk.
I hope that goes on my gravestone.
I like a good head bonk? That's how you passed away. R.I.P.
Alanis Morissette adds it to her song.
She sings at your funeral. Anyways, that's the voice of Mark Hoffmeyer. Mark is here, and John Levingood, as always, you guys are here, and we're going to talk about two specific movies, right?
Yeah, but before we do that, I got something that's going to blow your mind.
I cannot wait.
All right, guys. So, Brendan Fraser, his character Link from Encino Man, he has cameos in Son-in-Law and In the Army Now.
I actually remember those.
So three Pauly Shore movies. He was the star in Encino Man. He had two cameos as Link. So Link got out of the caveman thing, and he went to college, and then he went in the Army. I figured he'd become a lawyer, like Phil Hartman's caveman lawyer. But I guess he's doing okay. So it's kind of like a sequel that we'll never get, but we know he's okay.
Wait, hold on. So Pauly Shore, right? We see him in high school with Sean Astin in Encino Man. We see him in college with Carla Gugino in Son-in-Law. And then he sees his old buddy. They kind of, they aren't as close as they were in high school. It happens sometimes with close friends. They have their own little cliques, right?
Wait. I guess
he likes the people. And then they go on to the Army, and you know, they're even more deviating. But hold on. Does this mean that, like, Marvel stole the movie universe idea from Pauly Shore movies?
I think so.
That would have been awesome.
Sue Marvel.
You know what makes me even sadder? Like, they didn't even recognize each other in the Army Now. So that means they really grew apart.
Well, it had been long. And, like, Pauly Shore, like, come on. Like, he ended up being semi-fit and shaving his head. And
he didn't do the weasel gimmick anymore.
He was still talking about the wheeze, though.
Yeah. I mean, it is a cinematic universe. You got the Weasel. You got Link.
I don't know. If they don't show up after the credits, it's not – I don't think it counts. They have to show up after the credits, and he's got to, like, recruit them into some kind of team.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So, because of the post-credit scene, are you saying that Deadpool and Ferris Bueller's Day Off are in the same cinematic universe?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Whoa.
Anything with an ending credit scene, even counts bloopers. If there's bloopers during the credits, I count that as a Marvel Cinematic Universe. So like Anchor or no, Talladega Nights, Battle of Ricky Bobby. I think they're in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
They must be.
That came first though, so that means that the Marvel universe, the Marvel Galaxy falls in the Talladega Nights universe.
So you're saying that John C. Reilly from Talladega Nights, right?
Yes.
He
is the same John C. Reilly, yes, as
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. Same guy.
Whoa.
He stopped racing.
Whoa.
He didn't want to be second anymore. So that's what
he kind of became a second in command though.
All right, well, he didn't want to be second racing.
Yeah, there we go.
It's a little bit different. Yeah. Space travel.
Jeez. Everything's awesome.
Everything is awesome. The Lego Movie, part of the Marvel Chris Cinematic Pratt. Universe.
Yep. Wow.
Awesome. Well, now I've never hosted, but I'm going to go into questions because I think that's what you guys do, right?
I was just about to sneeze like a muffled listener question sneeze.
No, but that was perfect, though, because every time Lazo asked those questions, every episode, we've done like 63 of them, Lazo is always like, he goes, I think it's time for a listener question.
I believe today, right now, might be time for a listener question.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go into listener questions. All right, first listener question. Sarah? All right. From Clearwater, Florida, asks, why was there never a Fifth Element sequel? Guys, why?
Well, I mean, I've been reading a lot about this, actually. And the first one was a labor of love. It went tens of millions of dollars over budget. With inflation, it cost $150 million. In the States, it only made $95 million. And Luc Besson refuses to follow it up because he doesn't do sequels. He'll do a movie, then he'll have somebody do a sequel, but it's much cheaper. Like, you got Transporter, you have Taken. So then he'll have somebody else direct it. Mm. And he wants to tell – and now he's doing like a inadvertent sequel with Dane DeHaan. Like it's another sci-fi movie in the future. So like it's like his spiritual sequel to Fifth Element.
Is it real? I don't know what that movie is. Is this in any way in the same style of movie?
No, But he just said, he wanted to make another sci-fi movie, and he said he refuses to do another Fifth Element. The only reason he wants to do another Fifth Element maybe is because he thinks the technology's better.
But does that really warrant another one just because the technology's better?
Nah, probably not.
Nah.
That had such an interesting cast that I wouldn't want to see it without like
Chris
almost
Tucker.
Everyone who makes sense to come back.
Yeah. And plus, he and Mila Jovovich got divorced in 99.
Yeah.
So
he was married to her?
Yeah, they got married 7 months after the premiere of Fifth Element, and they divorced after Joan of Arc.
And now Mila Jovovich is married to Paul W.S. Anderson, right?
Yep, she keeps marrying the directors.
Yeah, makes sense. Hey, she's smart. Now she's got her whole series, Resident Evil.
Wait, is he the guy who did Resident Evils?
Yeah. That's why she's in them. They created a character just for her, pretty much.
So just like Len Wiseman made Kate Beckinsale's hair look amazing while she was manhunting in Total Recall.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so that's why Mia Jovovich always has these super snazzy outfits and the best shots of her eyes ever in her movies.
Like, Total Recall should be called, like, Kate Beckinsale's hair.
Comment.
Pretty much. Like,
comma.
Kate Beckinsale's hair puts Colin Farrell in a front choke.
Yeah. And then they put Jessica Biel in cargo pants.
That is a waste of a fantastic butt.
So this Fifth Element, and everyone was mad about the making of it. It took forever. I read that Gary Oldman only did it because he owed Luc Besson money from another production.
Did it do well in theaters? Debated. I don't remember. Did it do well?
Yeah, I mean, it made, with inflation, $95 million, and then it did $295 million worldwide. And that's – I didn't even add inflation into that. So it made its money back.
Right.
But – back in the day, that it wasn't a massive hit here. You know, Spawn made about the same amount of money, and that was considered a dud.
Yeah.
So I think it grew on DVD, but like that didn't really happen in the 90s, right? Big DVD hits like that spawned another movie. It's like that happened to Boondock Saints, but that happened 10 years later.
Right.
I can't, like, Shawshank did a sequel.
Oh, man.
It should have. People who were in VHS Columbia House clubs.
Oh, I did Columbia House.
You know, like, you just got, like, DVDs for – getting DVDs was like getting, like, those laser discs in the 80s. Like, you only do it for the super amazing movies, but your other 100 movies are on VHS.
Yeah.
I think the first movie I saw on DVD was Red Planet.
What?
That, I don't know why I remember that.
Interesting way to introduce yourself to higher resolution, guys.
Yeah, it was.
Deep blue sea.
That's a good one, man.
I feel like you just said a cool movie title, and that had nothing to do with the transition to DVD.
That was the first DVD I bought. I was a junior in high school, and I bought a DVD player for $218, and I went and bought Deep Blue Sea for $25 at Target.
Holy shit. Wait,
what year?
99.
Wait, hold on. I'm just doing the calculations here. So $218.99, that's the equivalent of like 10,000 of today's dollars, right? Yeah.
Pretty close.
That was really expensive back then, though, for real. That was expensive.
Yeah, I bought Analyze This for like $29.
I bet that looked good in DVD.
Yeah,
it's so much better than VHS.
Yeah.
It's like, I really need to get it on Blu-ray. That's
I just wanted to see Robert De Niro do that U.
Oh, yeah.
U.
Oh.
You. With his finger pointing in high def.
So is the answer to this question Robert De Niro, or what did you have, Love and Good?
So honestly, I would have been so nervous to see a sequel made. The only reason I would have wanted a Fifth Element 2 is if originally this was presented almost like the Lord of the Rings trilogy or the Star Wars series, where, look, you're going to approve me to do this one portion of this huge story, but if it's a hit, I get to follow through and do these other things, and you already kind of have contracts drawn. Like, you know, where you knew already, not this rocked, oh, well, now I'll come up with another story to continue it. That I don't like as much, you know? So if this was written as a saga, I would have wanted it. But because it wasn't, I feel like the Lords of Good Taste have protected us from a bad sequel.
Yeah, like Speed 2.
Oh, my God. That classic. I was listening to the We Hate Movies podcast about that movie yesterday, and it just reminded me how soul-crushingly awful that movie was.
I have a theory for you guys. No movie with Wave Runners is good. I just watched a Point Break remake, had Wave Runners, not good. Speed 2, Wave Runners, not good.
Waterworld?
Runner,
not good. Waterworld, I love that, but people hated it.
Yeah,
it bombed. I'd say the majority of movies with Police Academy 5. If they have a Wave Runner, it's not going to be good.
But I do want to say Independence Day 2 is out now, and that's 20 years since the first one. They could just spark up one day, just be like, hey, let's make a Fifth Element sequel. Let's see who we can get back. Oh, we can't get Bruce Willis. Let's just have Bruce Willis's son.
Oh. Right, and I love the new Mad Max movie, even though it's sort of a sequel or sort of a standalone and sort of not. But that aside, yeah, I was very pleased with that. That 20 years later thing is kind of cool.
See, you had me going, Robert, because we just were talking about Wave Runners, and then you were talking about 20 years later on Independence Day, and I'm like, is Jeff Goldblum going to be on a Wave Runner in space?
I really hope so. Even if it's not in space, if there's just like a 20-minute scene of him just on a Wave Runner, just having fun.
Yeah, just like a happy song, like Wave Runner.
Remember how in Jupiter Rising, Channing Tatum had his like hover
intergalactic roller skates?
Yeah, right. So like, if they made a Jupiter Rising 2, he'd have like a hover Wave Runner in space.
Oh my gosh,
yeah, it's like Michael J. Fox on the skateboard and then on a hoverboard. Like you have to up the ante a little bit.
Ooh. I want that song to be like Wave Running, Jeff Goldblum.
Sang by
and
Huey Lewis,
like played by Stryker from the 80s.
I was gonna say Huey Lewis in the News.
Yeah,
that's the power of love.
Or you get that band that did the Dream Warriors theme song for Nightmare on Elm Street. Their name was Dokken.
Oh yeah.
Oh wow.
Dream Warriors. Remember that?
It's just the same song, played with a Wave Runner.
If Jeff Goldblum Wave Runned, he would only use one hand.
Space like, Wave Runner.
He would have one hand on his lap, and then the other one would be driving the Wave Runner.
See, I think one would be driving, and the other one would be making, like, hand motions to, like, whatever he was saying.
Yeah,
like, you know, just to animate more, like, what he's trying to get across.
I like, hey, look at that dolphin.
Yeah, as he stutters his way through the line.
Dude, the answer is Robert De Niro shaking his finger on a Wave Runner in high def on a DVD in 1999.
There it is.
There you go. So, question number one's answered.
So, John, you said you had something about question two, right?
Okay, so, Robert, why don't you read the question? And then after that, I need to give a disclaimer. I need to give a strong disclaimer about the question afterwards.
Oh, gosh.
All right.
Please, Robert, if you would.
All right, so question number two. Dave from Tallahassee, Florida, asks, if Gamora fought Black Widow, whose ass would look best in black leather?
Okay, wow. Let's be clear. That is a misogynistic question. And what's funny is that when I was asking my friend to give me a listener question, he gave me that and he said, oh, no, I'm sorry. That's stupid. You wouldn't use that. And I said, oh, no, that question's great. I love that question. And he said, really? I said, yeah, I'm going to use that. We're using that. And he says, oh, okay. And so it's been a week, right? And every now and then I think about it. But it was only today that I really started to put, you know, pen to paper and put my answer together. And I was doing a Google search, right, just to get images and to, you know, get my answer straight. And you're thinking, why does John need a Google search for this? And it's because I thought the question was, what if not Gamora, but Gamora and Black Widow fought, whose ass would look better in black leather? And Gamora is the 500-foot-tall turtle alien monster from the old Godzilla movies. I'm not kidding. So the whole time I thought it was that. So that's why I thought it was a great question. If I knew this was actually comparing women's asses in black leather, I would not have agreed to take this question.
I read this question. I went, oh my.
Honestly, that's what I thought it was. I thought it was the old Godzilla monster.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I literally did until you just said that.
See, I thought it was, I was like, can we add like Deadpool and Captain America in here to like make it better for our listeners? Like, so when it's just not three men talking about leather pants. I'm like, let's add some, you know, let's add Deadpool.
So, I mean, I have a question. I have an answer regarding the two women, but it's not nearly as interesting as the process of realizing what this question really was. So I'm looking at pictures of Godzilla fighting Gamera, right? And I'm trying to imagine, like, how is it getting leather pants over that spiky Ninja Turtle body? Like, it's not, like, it would look stupid. So I guess I'd like that more than ScarJo in a way, because it's weird, right? Yeah. It's just funny. I don't know.
A giant turtle in any kind of pants would be awesome.
A 500-foot tall turtle.
Yeah. If it was 400 foot, I probably wouldn't like it, but 500 foot, that you nail it.
And what's interesting is that, as I recall, Gamera kind of like had, they were almost like rocket jets coming out of his rear, so he could rocket forward. I might be confusing this with another Godzilla monster, but I think I'm on this.
Is he like one of those tremors that they call the ass blasters?
Oh, my God.
That's a literal name.
Yeah, it was.
Ass blast. I've actually been watching all the direct-to-DVD Tremors films lately.
And, I only saw up to the third one.
Gotcha.
But if it did that, it would now have a big, like, butthole in the butt area.
So it'd be like Chaps.
Right. I think that this Gamera idea is way better than Gamora.
I'm so happy the question went this way, because I was worried about this.
Like, I know. And so Mark and I even talked about this before we recorded. I'm like, Mark, I have to tell you something about question number two. And he's like, oh, geez, Louise, I was wondering where you were going with that. I had to let him know so that he wouldn't like be upset that I had like I have an aneurysm putting pressure on the thought center of my brain and it's making me perverse or something. It's not the case.
Well, then I guess I pronounced it the right way, but I was totally thinking the giant turtle. I mean, I was why not pick Rodan? I think Rodan. Right. That now right. I get it. Now that you say that, but I think Rodan would look better in tight leather pants.
Oh, that, and you know what else? You know, like,
wait, which one's Rodan?
He's the flying pterodactyl one.
Three-headed dragon.
Oh,
right?
It's the dragon. No, hold on. I gotta look it up now. That might be it. What's the flying pterodactyl one?
Mothra? No.
No, that's the moth one.
Pterodactyl. Wait, Mothra. So it'd be Pterodactra.
Yeah, that's what it is.
I did used to watch those movies, man.
Like, oh, yeah, me too.
He would take that little, like, lizard guy. That had like the club, and he would spin them around and throw them at people.
Yeah, Rodan's the pterodactyl looking one. But what's that? Now that you say the three headed dragon,
Megazilla, Megalodon.
No, that's Mecha.
Mechazilla.
Wasn't it Godzilla? Wait, no, Godzilla King of Monsters, or was it Godzilla versus the King of Monsters, and that thing was the King of Monsters?
I don't know, but King Ghidorah is the three-headed dragon.
Okay, there we go. That's why I'm thinking King of Monsters. So Godzilla is the King of Monsters.
Yeah,
he's and that's just King Ghidorah.
Right.
Now, is he the official King of Monsters, or is that, like, unofficial?
I think he took a class in it, and he passed, and now he's just been labeled that. He got a ribbon.
So in Japan, he's probably got a legit certificate.
So he didn't live in an autonomous collective where the majority vote?
Nope. He was just awarded it.
He just represses people?
Yeah.
And some tart in a lake handed him a sword?
Yep.
like it.
Pretty simple.
But yeah, so my buddy Dave from Tallahassee obviously didn't mean the Godzilla monster when he suggested this and was shocked that I liked it.
But that's the answer, right? I mean, what answer are we going with?
Dude, the answer is – the answer to who looks better, Gamora or Black Widow, the answer is Gamora.
There you go.
Gamora.
That's a solid
answer. The answer is Gamora. You know, there was actually a theme song for Gamora because they later made him a hero in a subsequent movie after he was the bad guy fighting Godzilla. And it was like when they translated, it was Gamora is really neat. He is made of turkey meat. Of turtle. Gamora is really neat. He is made of turtle meat. We all love you, Gamora. This is a real thing.
Wow.
You can find this on YouTube.
Turkey meat?
Turtle meat. It's turtle meat. Damn it.
What would a turkey monster be? The gabba?
Yeah. The gabagool.
Like Godzilla versus Thanksgiving.
Gabazilla.
There you go.
Thanksgiving.
Gabba gabba doo.
Oh, man. That's a solid answer, though. I honestly, that's what I thought it was, and kind of let down that that's not what it was, but we turned it into that, so I'm okay now.
I'm so happy, guys.
Yeah. I know, you're relieved. You're thinking, oh, my God. Is John really going to put me in a corner and make me compare the curvature of these two women's butts? Look, both of those women are very attractive, very lovely, and excellent actresses, and that's the other answer.
There you go.
Excellent actresses.
Solid
this was
answer.
Like us in college. We probably could have talked an entire podcast about this, but now, you know, it's a little 10, 12 years later.
Probably would have.
Yeah.
We'd make a whole podcast out of that question.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, every week it's just something about that.
Yeah.
About that topic.
Like, that wouldn't be an episode. This would be something that we revisit every week.
Yeah.
That would be the podcast.
And then when you listen to it, when you listen to it on the iPod, like, you can see, like, the picture's changing and it's just ass. That's it. That's just it. Back and forth. All right. Well, I guess that does it for question two, unless we're adding anything else. I guess we got the answer, right?
Mm-hmm. We answered that question as tastefully as that question could ever be answered.
Yeah. Yes. I think so.
And by that, I mean answering a totally different question.
Yeah.
I think the answer is Mark is relieved. That's what it is. All right, so does that make us go into our first movie discussion?
Yeah,
it sure does.
I think so.
That's about as smooth a segue as Lazabeth would normally have.
Yeah, I didn't feel like trying to, like, kind of, you know, segue ass or turtle to the witch.
Speaking of 500-foot-tall alien turtle monsters, how about that movie, The Witch?
Yeah, how about that small-budget movie, The Witch?
The New England folktale.
There was not a 500-foot-tall alien turtle monster in that New England folktale?
No, but there were some goats.
So
before good segue.
Yeah, there you go.
So I got a question for you guys. All right, so you got, you know, in our world, you know, not this folktale world that director Robert Eggers told on The Witch. If you could take a baby and smush it into like you know that Jell-O that has like cranberry and like fruit inside of it,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you could take a baby and smush it, right, and then slather yourself with it to fly,
mm-hmm.
Would you consider it?
I wouldn't. Then I saw The Witch, and now I would.
Okay, so we have one yes. What about you, John?
I'm not comfortable with smearing that all over myself. But in The Witch, she was rubbing it on her broom.
Yeah. Oh no, I thought she loaded herself. She loaded herself up with it.
No, so she's laying down. So it's an interesting thing about the you know, the subtlety of The Witch is how they don't show us very much of The Witch at all.
Mm.
The Witch is usually implied, right? Well, in that there's a scene in the trailer where The Witch is naked and laying down. Is this what you're thinking of, Mark?
Yeah, wait, she didn't lather herself up like a Nazi commercial?
She was rubbing something on the ground in front of her, and it was her broom. And there was no way for you to know it was her broom when you're watching the movie in the first place. It's only later when you see them going up on their brooms that, and some of them hover, and but they go up on their brooms, and they did that in the movie Warlock too. They go on the same premise that the rendered fat from an unbaptized boy.
I feel like she lathered herself up, man. I don't know what I'm.
Honestly, I can't remember, but I do know that one of them was on a broom at the end, right? That I recall. So like.
I think you're right, though, because I think James Wan talked about that movie Saw, and there's other horror movies where people think they're the most violent things ever, but then they watch them and they're like, oh.
It actually, so yeah, The Witch wasn't too gruesome
except
overall.
For the baby smushing.
Yeah.
Well, right, yeah. The sound. It yep. wasn't loud, but it was so quiet otherwise that it was just, oh my God, like that was creepy as hell.
Yeah.
Normally I forget a lot of stuff from movies, you know, but this memory is just imprinted in my brain. But I guess since I jumped ahead, do you want to tell them what the movie's about, Love and Good?
Sure. So hopefully people will be listening to our podcast in 20 years and they don't know if this movie is new to this episode or old. So there's a 2016 movie, The Witch. And if you follow our website now, anytime I've written about a witch movie, I always complain that all witch movies seem to suck. Or they're not really about the witch. The only ones I liked were Roald Dahl's The Witches, which was kind of a kid's movie, and The Craft, actually. But all the other witch movies aren't really about the witch, or they suck. And so this one is about this very, very devout New England settling family. And they're basically, now Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but they seem to be more devout than their city council.
Yeah, they didn't,
And get willfully excommunicated because they are damning the city council at their own trial.
Yeah, they want to be able to be more strict. So the father, this is like the 1600s, he moves them out into the middle of nowhere so they can practice their own form without being, you know, tied to these liberals back in
those liberals.
and we'll bring up there are a lot of things that temporally with the development of a family don't really coincide well with this very ethically stalwart decision. But they end up out in the wilderness. Things seem nice. They build a home. They have their crops. And their baby disappears. And we'll talk more about their baby disappearing. But their baby disappears. And then there's a lot of distrust that manifests within the family about the source of the baby's disappearance, the cause of it. And there's worry of a witch, connection to the devil. And it just, it snowballs into an avalanche.
And the baby gets stolen in the worst game of peekaboo ever.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's this girl. The actress's name is Anya Taylor-Joy. And she is playing this game of she's above a baby. The baby's on the ground and she's leaning over it playing peekaboo. She covers her eyes, opens them up, and the baby's gone. You hear rustling through the leaves.
Yeah. And it's like 100 feet at the tree line, you know, in 2 seconds.
Yeah. So whatever
Baby stealer made it 200, like 100 feet.
Like she would be a great wide receiver.
Oh yeah.
Any football player. Can you imagine the inertia with that speed?
Like she got in there without crunching on anything.
And then
she got out.
Yeah. With only crunching out a few things.
Yeah.
Rushing for 1,000 yards a season, no problem.
So she sprinted in, didn't make any crunchies.
Yep.
Then she ran out and made the crunchies.
She made one bush, like, kind of slightly move.
I wonder if she did to mess with the girl. Like,
yeah, like someone was definitely here, like, yeah. Just to show you.
You know, I think it'd be less scary to watch a witch take a bush and go, you know what I mean? Like, that
like
would
far
wreck
away?
Everything for
oh,
me.
Oh, man, that would be creepy. Like, just far away, you see just some crotchety old woman just sitting down behind a bush, just shaking it. That'd be pretty scary.
Some other witch with a tree walking towards you, like,
God.
And then stops.
That's scarier than not seeing anything.
And, you know, it's one of the neat things. So we just saw what had to be, like, an instance of magic, right? Because in the span of a second and a half, the witch either traveled or magically appeared 100 feet and then moved another 100 feet back into the tree line, right?
Yep.
But so that's a ridiculous, impossible feat. But the movie presents it so subtly that the real stunning nature of it is the girl's reaction and the fact that the baby is gone. Mm. You're not really processing how. It's not like in Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, where a witch literally runs in at 1,000 miles an hour, grabs it, and goes off like the Flash.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so crass like that. So I thought that was really cool, the way that they handled that.
Yeah. And this is, I know I'm going off topic, but about the production, Robert Eggers, the director, this is his first time feature. And I don't know if you guys noticed, but he came from a production design background. And the sets that he built, he only built them with old tools.
Oh, wow.
So they only built them with tools that they had back then. and they mostly filmed with natural light. So it's just very, it's not like forced. It doesn't, you know, I think some movie, like I watch Warcraft and they're like, oh, we wanted to make the orcs realistic. Like they succeeded, but they lost everything else. But right. this movie, everything feels very
authentic.
Yeah, authentic. And it doesn't feel like fake. It doesn't feel faux authentic. It feels very
Oh, they're speaking
authentic.
Old English, too. I mean, it's like, yeah. it's hard to follow at sometimes, but you feel like you are just watching this family, like, just live out in the wilderness. And it's crazy, like, how authentic it feels and how, like, you're saying, the production design, like, some of those shots and stuff of just the house with the backdrop of, like, the wood line, like, it's crazy. And, like, I guess they filmed it in Canada. That's what I read.
I don't know. We can type that in later.
Yeah. I think they filmed it in Canada, like, kind of out in the sticks. At least that's where I read. And it's just, like, really far out. It was, like, the best place that they could do. They're going to try New England, but I guess, like, because of taxes and everything, they decided to go with Canada. And,
yeah, they go to Georgia.
Yeah, right next to The Walking Dead. Yeah. You see Terminus is in the background.
Yeah. So they this is also interesting. I don't know if you guys knew this, but the film ran out of money. So the director had no more money to edit it. He had no more studio time. And Chris Columbus, the director of Home Alone, saved it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
It was a million budget, right? $1 million?
Yeah, really low, really low. And they shot with natural light, which cut the days. And, like, they got two – but the actors – I'm amazed. We talked about Honeymoon recently, and they had two really good actors in Rose Leslie and Harry Treadaway. You know, Hush had John Gallagher Jr. But then you watch this movie, and Ralph Ineson and Kate Dickey, they're both from Game of Thrones. So one of the ladies is the mom who has the moon door.
She's breastfeeding her 12-year-old.
Yeah. And then Ralph Ineson's, like, one of the brotherhood without banners. And but yeah, I thought everybody's, like, looked Puritan in this movie. They looked rough.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the casting was perfect.
I love the ensemble cast. Like, I love just, like, all the characters. Because there's, what, four kids? The mother, the father, and then the baby. Mm-hmm. And two of the kids were twins. And, like,
that's right.
I don't know.
Which is naturally creepy.
Yeah, that's just already creepy. Because they were getting blamed for being witches, just like... Anya or whatever her name is, she was getting blamed for being a witch, and just, like, you know, just everybody was untrustworthy.
And they asked a lot of those kid actors too. I'm amazed they got the performances out of those little buggers.
Oh yeah, it was great.
And then, what do you guys think about? So there's a scene where, you know, at the end, it's the twins and the older girl Anya, and they're in this barn with Black Phillip, a goat. And they hear a stomp on the roof. Did you guys freak out when that happened?
That almost removed me from my nice, comfortable viewing, if you will. It almost made me feel like I was watching another movie for a second.
Oh, you didn't like the jump scare?
To me, it felt – I mean, it's jump scares are fun, but that was – that in the last 30 seconds of the movie felt a little out of place to me.
Hmm. See,
that nature, that bang. I mean, I suppose the witch was landing on the top, right?
Mm.
But just the delivery, it didn't fit for me.
I didn't.
I was like, sorry. Robert, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, I didn't mind it. I think there was only really two jump scares that, like, really caught me. The other one was with the goat and the father. Like, oh, that one was kind of out of nowhere, too. And,
dude,
like,
when that goat gored the dad.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Since we consider this to be like a PG-13 show, I wrote notes while watching this movie, and I wrote about seven notes, and one of them was the goat fucks that guy up.
Yeah.
Wait, that's our, like, until we get past the hour mark, that's the only F-bomb I think we get.
Yeah. I mean, it gores him and then rams him and then done, like, just done.
It was crazy. And then, but it made me kind of feel weird at the end, because at the end she gets led. Black Phillip kind of talks her into signing a contract, and she walks in the woods with all these other witches. But all those brooms were flying because they mushed up the brother and sister, the twins.
I'm assuming, yeah.
Right, or assuming to some interpretations, just the boy.
Oh, really?
Because it's an unbaptized boy.
Oh,
that's I'm pretty that That's the way that I've usually heard it. And that's even how the movie, not that I'm using this as my basis, but that's how the movie Warlock handled it as well. It was specifically the unbaptized boy.
Because the boy was buried.
The boy is the name carrier. Women didn't have much, sorry to say it, but value back then. Right. So it was like this would be the carrier of the family. He's unbaptized. He's vulnerable. And so it is in his body that you can find the power.
So they put the younger girl in like wind sprint camp so that she can become fast like the other ones?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
What,
yeah. Why they were just trying to turn her into a witch just to get more witches. I mean, that was Satan's plan.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, it just helps their cause of
he's like a recruiter. Maybe he's like
a line.
Maybe he has recruiters out there and they work on like a commission.
They're all goats. Yeah. Just walking around trying to find new women to turn into witches.
Yeah, hey, what's up?
But, and that goat legitimately felt like a character, and it very much empowered that from the start, not middle of the movie, but from the start, the kids named it Black Phillip.
Oh,
and you just think it's a red herring. You're like, well, it's not going to be Black Phillip.
Yeah.
Like, and it's Black Phillip.
You know, they wanted Black Phillip to do more, but he was like really he didn't obey at anything. So they had to cut a lot of stuff out of the script.
I thought that goat worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
He's at craft services just like, yeah. Fuck this. I'll be back later.
He's eating all the Doritos. Maybe it was a case of Jaws, you know, less is more. And so maybe that worked out for him.
That made it seem all the more creepy, and the minimalistic approach that kind of hit most aspects of this movie.
Yeah, and I know, you know, this is pretty interesting. The Church of I don't think it's the Church of Satan. It's the Satan something. They fully backed it, this movie.
Hmm.
But the director was kind of saying that he directed it without an agenda. He just wanted to put it there for people and leave it for interpretations. So I thought that was pretty interesting. He's like, I made it without an agenda, and that's kind of like the first agenda that people took with it. So maybe he didn't want to like fully embrace that they were embracing it, but I thought that was pretty interesting too, because I didn't feel like it was – I felt like it was very voyeuristic.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't somebody pushing their agenda. It was very, I'm going to let you watch this unfold. And I didn't like it. I was kind of annoyed by it because I in my head – I don't really like anything that makes it seem like the Salem witch trials were actually witches. Like, and they,
right.
I mean, those were murders. And so I was like, I don't know if I like this. But then I talked to a friend. He's like, Mark, it's a fairy tale. Like, it's a folk tale. He's like, this is a folk tale. And I loved it more. Not loved it, but I appreciated it a lot more because of that. Because he's just basically telling a folk tale that gets passed through the ages.
So right after you saw it, you weren't like a huge fan of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I liked it. I liked all the artistic merit, the acting. But I was like, well, it's kind of like making it seem like that there actually were witches.
Right.
But once I talked to my good buddy Zach, who directed a movie called Interior, won a bunch of awards, great horror film, watch the trailer, interiormovie.com. But we talked and we talked about it being a folk tale. And I don't know, did you feel that way, guys, at all or no?
I wouldn't have called it that, but I also wouldn't have suggested that this was ever insinuating that witches were real. It wasn't, again, I agree, it wasn't making a statement at all.
Yeah.
It was presenting a reality in which there were witches. Whether or not that had ever happened is irrelevant.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that to the calling it a folktale is that kind of like in filmmaking, this, that, or the other, like sometimes a lot of components in Act 1 are already there that will be important in Act 3 for it to work. And in this case, like you had this family that was already on some kind of questionable grounds. They're alienated kind of by their own choice, but using religion as a vector. And now they're challenged with the fear of the antithesis of their religion, the devil, right? And or not the antithesis, but you know what I mean, the counterpoint to God. And when all this is happening, they have when you look at the time, they have a barely dawning pubescent girl in the family. And back then, historically, that was the age that you would be promising her and or marrying her off.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of interesting historical analysis reasons for that. And it's not just for social means. It's to release the financial burden to the family. That's the lowest import. The highest import is, in fact, that she is now challenging by sheer presence the mother's role of woman in the household. She is now a fertile woman in the household, as the mother is no longer as fertile. She's drawing temptation from siblings, potentially, who are of age where they start to notice this. And she is of an age where you begin to gain countenance, if you will, from the temptations of the devil. So there was a lot stacked against this family in the deck, if you will, for their situation to be paranoid, because they already had these other burdens on them, these other social historical burdens. So it's a weird situation. I did some reading about it. I didn't know any of this, by the way. Then these are other people's ideas. I don't know how broadly accepted these notions are, but this is what I read in a few sources. I thought it was interesting.
Nice. And, you know, this movie exploded. There's a lot of talk. I wrote this post called 10 Films That Can Unite the Art House and the Grindhouse. And I wrote that in response to this article by this guy called Jason Kaufman. And he wrote, "This is why we can't have nice things, the witch in horror fandom's gatekeepers." And The Witch is 91% from critics on Rotten Tomatoes, but it's 55% from audiences. And a lot of audiences, there was a lot of backlash from audiences about this film because they were reading reviews how it's the scariest movie, you know, in decades. And they watch it and they're like, "This isn't scary. It's stupid."
It's one of the creepiest movies.
Yeah. But I think they went in with these weird expectations, and that we've been talking about this, these recent horror hybrids, they're very different from traditional like slasher horror, or a lot of the things that people in the internet age, 80s, 90s, have kind of grown up with. I know there are, you know, lower budget movies that you can watch, and if you're a true like genre fan, horror hound, you understand it, like, you know, Levingood, you appreciated it. But there are some, like, he kind of called these people knuckle draggers. He's like, if there's not a slasher, they hate it. And so there's this huge discussion, which I really liked, about, you know, what is horror and why are these gatekeepers fighting such good genre pieces? And so I don't know. I thought that was interesting. So if you go to the site, you'll see.
The writer of that in the first place, though, the first thing I think of when I hear that person's opening statement, if you will, is, you know, you don't have to like every movie for it to be good.
Right. I think you have to look at it unbiasedly. Like, it can be – there's a lot of movies that are good that I don't really – it's not my cup of tea. It's not one of my favorite movies, but I can acknowledge, like, certain movies are just good movies. And I liken this more to something along the lines of Rosemary's Baby, which, again, is creepy, not necessarily, like, in-your-face, scary, jump scares galore or anything like that. It's just a creepy atmosphere throughout the movie, and that's what this felt like. It was just creepy throughout.
I'd agree. Yeah. This is one of the creepiest movies, not scariest, but creepiest movies that's been released in a long time. Not because it was the most creepy at any moment, but because it was the most consistently creepy. Like, from the start, from that
the music
trial, it's just weird.
Yeah, and then the music throughout was just, I don't know. Consistently creepy.
And the thing with this movie is that the problem with tone pieces like Rosemary's Baby, which is amazing, or this one, is you kind of have to invest yourself in watching it. You kind of have to immerse yourself a little bit. And I think a lot of audiences nowadays probably – I can't speak for everybody, but you see a lot of the young kids in the theaters with, like, their phones on and, like, you know, they're looking at different things. And, like, I think it's a movie you kind of have to, like, dive in.
Mm-hmm. Forgive me if I'm quoting your words from the wrong movie in context, but didn't you write something like – you feel sorry for the casual, like, date nighters strolled into this movie expecting a scary popcorn flick or something?
Yeah, like, you know, a nice couple, right? 19 years old, right? The kid's in college, and he's like, "Well, I'm dating this girl. She's out of my league. I'm going to take her to a nice movie. You know, she loves The Conjuring. So we're going to go watch this movie, The Witch. I hear it's great. You know, I hear it's great." They go to this little theater. There's a bunch of, like, hipsters staring at him, drinking PBR. They sit down, and then a baby gets mushed. You know, like it's not a good date night movie for people casually strolling into it.
If she just likes to be scared and clutch her arm, not to sound sexist with that statement, by the way, but if that was the goal of the guy or the girl in going into this movie, there's not going to be a second date because they're just going to leave, like, white faced.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the first, you know, I'm the opposite with my wife. She doesn't jump at anything, and I'm jumping all over the place. But the first movie we ever watched together was Drag Me to Hell, and we're married. So that's a good first date movie right there, Drag Me to Hell, if you're thinking about that.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
You've been championing that as a date night movie, I think, in half a dozen episodes. Yeah. And so many of our listeners are just shaking their head like, really? They probably think that you have Freddy posters pasted all over your bedroom wall. Nope, not the case. Just a couple cinephiles.
I got Wes Anderson posters.
Close enough.
I do. And a Wayne's World guitar.
Nice. Yeah. All right. Well, anything else on The Witch before we take a break?
Nah, break time.
All right. Yeah. Let's.
Everyone did a fantastic job. It was a fantastic job.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Baby Goo looked great.
Oh, oh my.
When you say Baby Goo, that's not bad.
I'm going Black Phillip for Academy Award Best Actor nominee. That's what I'm hoping. That's what I'm hoping.
He's the goat.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, let's take a break here and we'll come back and do the rest of the questions and talk about Conjuring 2.
Robert.
Mm-hmm.
John.
Yes.
Complete the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. What are we doing?
Counting.
Oh, counting, yeah. Counting what?
Down?
Counting down what? Everything?
Everything and anything.
Anything and everything?
That's right. The three of us, we count down from 5 down to 1. Top 5, everything and anything that you can think of. You want to know the top 5 shittiest bands? You want to know the top 5 movies? Listen, Shark Dropper Studios, sharkdropper.com.
All right, and we're back.
I think.
Maybe. Right now, I wasn't going to mention this, but I just have to. I'm sure John has mentioned this plenty of times as he's looking at me right now from the floor. Basically, this studio is like a sauna. It's so hot in here, especially being in Florida. It's just so hot. And then not only that, my air conditioning broke today, so it's even hotter.
Whoa. I just had to repair mine, man. That's a pretty penny.
Yeah, it's...
Or completely switch it out.
Well, I'm turning off the breaker right now. Like, I've been trying to do that and, like, shut it down for a little bit and then turn it back on. Hasn't worked yet. Really hoping it comes back on because I'm literally sweating in here. It feels like a sauna.
It's like a bad case of swamp ass in there.
Oh, yeah. It's the worst case of swamp ass right now.
I saw John and John were in there last week, and they had just gone to engine number 9 and eaten a ton of beef. And I was looking at Levengood throughout the hour and a half of us recording, and he went from like no sweat to covered in sweat.
Yeah.
Like it was just like he was dripping like baked bean size sweat bead balls down his face.
usually I'm not too bad. Like I don't sweat that often. I can usually be okay. But like when the more people in the room, like obviously you're just going to get that body heat. But right now It's just me and obviously John on the floor. But it's just me and like I'm sweating like so much right now. There's just no air. And not only that, when the air was on, it was blowing out hot air. That's why I had to just shut it off. I'm like, no more heat. So anyways, I'm going to try not to pass out during this last half of the podcast, but let's get to questions. Let's see. All right. So we got our last listener question. This one's from Sarah again from Clearwater, Florida. And she asked the important question, will Norman Reedus make good Ghost Rider? I don't know if that's how it's supposed to be written, but that's what it says.
Make a good Ghost Rider.
Okay, yeah.
So like how could we construe make good Ghost Rider? Is that like a food? Like make good pasta?
How do you make good Ghost Rider? How do you make it?
Make good. Make good. Could he make good Ghost Rider?
Could he make a good Ghost Rider? We'll say A. We'll put the A in there.
Okay. I mean, this is what I see in my head, right? Picture like a Blade 2 type film. Guillermo del Toro, bring Norman Reedus back because he was in that. And if they can kind of capture like a dark tone, not like a PG-13 Nicolas Cage Ghost Rider tone, they tried it on the second one, but it looked too digital. They need to make it look grimy. Like it needs to capture, you know, the grime. Does that make sense? Like it needs to. Like,
yeah.
And does Norman, I haven't watched Walking Dead in a few seasons. Does he say more than one line at a time?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, he does.
Okay.
Sometimes.
Cause I don't ever picture him like monologuing.
No, I mean, and this is all in reference to him saying that he would like to play the character, right? Like, I remember seeing an interview, and he said he wanted to play the character. Not that they were actually in talks, though. Like, right? They're not in talks to have him.
Hey, how did Ryan Reynolds get a Deadpool movie?
Oh, there you go.
It took years.
So he needs to make a bad Ghost Rider movie where he's part of a team, right? Yep. And then 10 years later, he needs to get his own Ghost Rider movie.
I think he can just start his campaign the way he did. I think it'd be fine. But that sounds like a path that would have more moviegoers suffering, is what you're suggesting.
A PG-13 movie with like Ghost Rider, Norman Reedus as Ghost Rider, Dolph Lundgren as Cable.
And Wolverine's still in there.
Yeah, Kate Winslet as Rogue.
Hey.
Kate Winslet
as Rogue?
Yep.
Okay.
I would hate that movie. You got a recipe for me to hate that movie.
Matthew McConaughey as Gambit.
Draw me like one of your French girls.
Yeah.
Deadpool.
And then we'll do Melissa McCarthy as...
The Phoenix.
Make it PG-13. Direct a guy who has never directed a big budget film before, right?
Right.
Make it PG-13. Have it bomb. Bring in Richard Donner for reshoots, right? They make it. It's flopped universally, right? But there's a couple good moments. People are like, it sucked, but I like Norman Reedus. Or like they did with Wonder Woman and Batman vs. Superman. I look like Goldblum with my hands right now. Sorry, guys. You can't really see it. And then they're like, 10 years later, Reedus, you know, he'd be like, hey, man. Ghost Rider, baby.
So this is like 10 years in the future. He's got a lot of planning to do before this actually happens.
12 years in the future because they still have to go into production and make that movie. So 12 years from now, Norman Reedus, Ghost Rider.
Okay. I'll look forward to it. When How old would he
Walking
be?
Walking Dead season 18.
Yeah. When he has a trike.
Daryl is still, oh, God. And he's overweight. Yeah. He's like those fat twins on motorcycles from the 90s.
I tell you what, though, I work Comic Cons for you. Actually, I still work Comic Cons, and John worked with me, and we had to deal with Norman Reedus lines that were like 1,000 strong. And I think if he really started like a petition or like really pushed for this, he has a very loud and vocal internet following. They could make some waves.
If he did a year of cons, his regular con schedule, and he actually had a petition there, he's like, hey, would you sign that for me to be Ghost Rider? He'd get 2,000 signatures per convention at the moderate-sized ones.
Yeah.
Physical, not online people clicking. Physical signatures. At the end of a year, he could end up with like 50,000 real signatures or more.
Yeah, and then probably like 5 million internet. Like,
and next year he's going to be in his own video game, Hideo Kojima's new game. Like that, when Silent Hills like ended up getting canceled, now they have a new game coming out, and he's like the head character in that. I think he's going to have a lot of pull soon.
He's huge in Japan too, so like that's like a big.
He's a regular Gamora.
Yeah, put him in some leather pants.
Yep. Oh, definitely. And, all the girls would go gaga.
I don't think I've ever remembered Norman Reedus saying more than one sentence at a time. So I'd be worried about him playing, like, carrying a movie.
Yeah. Well, just no monologues.
Yeah.
Ghost Rider doesn't need to talk that much.
Like, Machete doesn't text. Ghost Rider doesn't monologue.
Yeah.
Well, you know, just not that it's a winning recipe, but take the softer spoken Kevin Costner in Waterworld approach. Like, he doesn't have to say a lot to say things that have impact.
He just kind of smacks around women and throws them around, then kills a large fish and feeds them. He wastes a lot of meat in that movie. He kills a sea beast that's probably endangered, and then he gives these two people just like a couple chunks of it.
Yeah, like, he saves like 4 pounds.
And where is this monster? If he could take out the boat, just kill a dolphin and feed it to him.
Kill a dolphin.
Save some meat.
Ah, it's dolphin safe.
Yeah. Some grouper. That's just my thing, guys. Sorry. Waterworld.
Hey, not to get off topic, which it's going to be completely off topic. Did you see that video of the grouper that ate that shark? That's
no,
intense.
Yeah.
That's intense. What? I'm just saying, check it out. There's
it's like a 600 or 800 pound grouper.
Yeah. Oh my God. Well, there's a video of like some guy fishing and he caught a shark. And as he's reeling in the shark, a grouper just comes out of nowhere, grabs the entire shark, and then goes back down. It's intense. I'm just saying, check it out. I mean, not to derail the whole podcast, but that's an important movie to watch.
Dude, Liam Neeson said it best, man. There's always a bigger fish.
Yeah. That's true. That classic line.
That's a Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
That's right. Or as we heard from Deuce Bigelow, that's a big bitch. Farouk.
So what is the definitive answer for will Norman Reedus make good Ghost Rider?
800-pound soft-spoken grouper that's endangered by Kevin Costner. I don't know.
With no monologues.
Maybe ride the grouper.
Yeah, there you go. On fire.
Yeah, a flaming grouper? Yeah. Ooh, that'd be tasty after a while.
He eats it right after he like jumps out of the ocean with it.
I'd be like, hey, Ghost Rider, can you take a ride and come back to my house in an hour?
Ghost Rider's just Aquaman all of a sudden. riding fish and shit.
That's kind of counterintuitive, but it could work.
That's true. It might put his fire out, but yeah, who knows?
He would look just like a dead person skeleton. Underwater then.
Then it's like undead skeletal Aquaman riding a grouper.
There's nothing more I want to see. And welcome back from all those people who just watched the grouper video.
Yeah, they literally just
paused us for a second.
they didn't even pause it. They're just watching it right now, like while we're talking. But okay, so that's the final answer.
Yep.
Ghost Rider riding a grouper,
yep.
Replacing Aquaman, and no monologues.
Love it.
Okay, sounds good. I guess that means we should get into the second movie of the evening. And that is Conjuring 2, which I did not see, so I'm going to let you guys take the reins.
Spoil it for you.
So that's for fine. All you people who have watched Conjuring 2 already, I just want to go, shall I say, would it be Ooh. A sin, but I can't help falling in love. Wait.
They pushed that Beautiful. Elvis envelope so hard in that movie that I really thought Elvis was the poltergeist. The whole
I thought Kurt Russell was going to bust through the wall and go, oh, yeah!
And there's our obligatory Kurt Russell inclusion in the podcast.
Patrick Wilson out Kurt Russell.
Not possible.
No.
Not possible. He was wearing sleeves the whole time.
Yeah. And there was no, like, cool cardigan, like in Insidious 2. I was really disappointed.
Wait, so The Conjuring 2. I got to say, right, and first off, don't listen other than Robert, who's recording with us.
I have to listen.
If you haven't seen the movie.
I have to listen to it.
Right. But everyone else, even if you love us, you should really go watch this movie first. I certainly recommend that you see it. I imagine Mark would recommend you see it.
Yeah.
So my overall opinion on this, though, is that it really shows that this is the only horror movie that The Conjuring Part 1, when you compare it to Part 2, it really shows that the first Conjuring was the only horror movie that Lee Whannell did not write with James Wan, because all of the other movies have a lot of common elements that I see coming together. Not in a bad way, but it's like the Guillermo del Toro notion with a lot of elements that I see repeated in a lot of his work. A lot of these characters are going to, the bad characters are going to feel very familiar. But I thought that this was at least as entertaining as Part 1. Maybe more entertaining, right? More roller coaster.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically like a roller coaster fun house.
But I'd say that as a film, it is not as good as Part 1.
Yeah, I would say, yeah. And this is going to sound weird because a lot of people have been complaining about this. And I didn't think it was an issue, but I did notice it. I remember sitting in the theater going... This is long, right? Like, I didn't worry about that, but like, it's a long movie.
So I'm gonna say that it didn't feel long in that sense, like, oh God, shouldn't this be over already? But instead, it was like, oh, okay, so I've seen X amount in my head. Like, it just feels like they're gonna resolve it here, and they, oh wait, here's the reappearance of this weird crooked man monster, and we still have 40 minutes to go. Like, it's. So, yeah, there was – in a way, though, that keeps you on your toes, right? We're kind of – as horror fans, we're kind of used to 30 minutes of character introduction with just a hint at the end of something strange. And then we are introduced to the strange. And then in kind of the third act is when everything elevates in urgency. And this was like – it had three third acts.
And what I love about James Wan's recent films – and I know I love all the Insidious movies. John, I think, likes them.
I agree. I think they're very, very entertaining. I don't think any of them are great films, but I think they are very, very good horror movies, and I think they are excellently entertaining. How's that?
And that's what I think of. That's why I like James Wan, and I wrote a post, James Wan is the king of mainstream horror. Oh, I said he's taking the horror genre further. Get it? The further.
I was wondering if that was on purpose.
No one got that, sons of bitches.
I got it.
Yeah. Hey, man, why are you leaving me out? But I like James Wan because in his horror films, I feel like he goes out of his way just to have fun with the audience. Like, you know, The Conjuring 2 right now is the number one audience-rated horror film of this decade. You know, there's been over a couple hundred. And audience, it's still fresh in people's minds, but it's the number one rated audience, you know, rated thing according to IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, Metacritic, combined scores. And so I think audiences respond. You know, it's made $200 million already, and I think his horror movies are just fun. They're legit scary. They actually feature heroes, like Insidious and The Conjuring feature heroes, which is rare in the horror genre, and they're fun. Like the set pieces in this movie, and they are familiar, but a lot of these set pieces are fun, and I think it has one of my favorite moments in horror, and probably. If I had to do like a top 16 of the 21st century, I would put it in that list. I guess we can get to it later. But it's basically a 3-minute long uncut scene where the camera is focused on Patrick Wilson looking away from this demon. This girl sits in – oh, man, I'm really getting ahead of myself.
No, it's okay. People okay. See the movie. We get to do this.
But so the person or thinking is haunting them died in this chair. So they have this girl who's being haunted sit in this chair. She puts water in her mouth to prove that she's actually channeling somebody, not making a voice. But the guy won't come out unless everyone turns their backs. So what follows is a 3-minute uncut scene with Patrick Wilson talking to this spirit. And in the background, you see the spirit kind of changing and like
molding.
Yeah, highly out of focus. You know, it's a very it's not like a rack. I guess it kind of rack focuses because it goes from the demon to him, and it's just focused on him. You know, like, and it's just a 3-minute long, very patient, well acted, and I had never seen anything like that in horror before. And here's a movie that like James Wan is still looking for ways to have fun, and I really appreciated that about The Conjuring 2, and that's a really smart scene, and I loved it. And that's why I love about these movies are there's the hand clap scene in the first film, and also with this movie, James Wan has a very roving camera. His camera never stays still. Obviously, he's not the DP, but when you watch his movies, what I like the most, especially with this film, is you have a very good sense of place in this home. You know where the rooms are. You know where the bedrooms are. You know the downstairs. So whenever action's breaking out in the home, you know where it's happening. And I was able to like really track this film really well, and I really appreciated that when the demon shit hit the fan, not literal demon shit.
You had pointed that out about part one in your article, I think, how the hand clap scene allowed us to kind of learn the mapping of the house.
Yeah.
And then in this one, even though it wasn't actually one shot. I think it was just CGI transition, but it was like it was one shot before anything weird had happened when the kids are playing in the house.
Yeah.
And you're going from room to room to room through a window, down through a door. And you get a very three-dimensional understanding. And I think that was pretty cool. And it also kind of creates the illusion in the second movie, not the first, with that one continuous shot. You know what I'm talking about in the beginning? Yeah. It was almost – that felt like – a force overseeing the family, even though it was before anything happened. A lot of those moving camera shots, those shifting camera shots, those were shots that standardly would be still.
Yeah.
And when he did it like that, and sometimes it was even just a slow draw to the right and down a little bit when it was totally not necessary. And it really gave me this feeling, or at least I remember thinking this, that it's almost like we're seeing a bodiless force observe people silently before it ever decided to take action. I don't know if that was intentional or if he was just trying to keep it edgy or cool or be stylish, but no matter what the desired effect, it had a positive effect on me.
I have a question with like House of the Devil and other movies like that. Do you remember the houses? Like Hush, I don't think captured the house too well either.
No, so it's interesting you say that, but I love House of the Devil. You know I loved House of the Devil.
Oh, I love it too. Yeah, it's great.
And that, it's like I know what the foyer and staircase looks like. I know what the hallway upstairs looks like. I know what a bedroom upstairs looks like. I know what the room with the pool table looks like and the kitchen looks like. I don't know where any of these things connect.
Yeah,
I have no idea whatsoever. It's interesting that you use that example because I remember it very well. But in most movies, you don't get a very good idea unless it's a small upstairs or a small house. And horror movies, isn't an interesting trend that even the poor people tend to have big houses?
Yeah, that thing's huge. I was listening
they always have big houses, and they're in London.
I was listening to the Empire podcast, and they're like, that's $1 million home. But I don't know. So It already spawned a spinoff. We're going to have a Nun. And I have a question, John. So in the beginning, it's the Amityville all over again. And Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson, the Warrens, are kind of doing a seance or whatever they do. And Vera Farmiga, who's an amazing actress, I can't believe they got her for this role. She gets harassed by this really jerky nun that would be nowhere near Sister Act. And that nun ends up being the main villain in London. So did that – I don't think the nun drew them there. I just think it's something Farmiga saw that could happen in the future. Right? Because
she had premonitions.
Yeah. So, like, you know, that scene in the house. Oh, man, talking about that scene. Holy crap. I just did, like, a little dance. I got goosebumps. But so that nun didn't bring them there. Right?
No, I would say absolutely not. I think that was a premonition that was happening while she was astrally projecting during a seance. That's how I kind of interpret that. Because there were no either red herrings or clues or anything that would actually suggest that they were drawn there.
I'm like, that's a long game.
I think it was a premonition. She had premonitions in the first movie.
Yeah.
Where she was nervous. She had a vision of this. She was nervous about proceeding. These weren't ever veiled as things that she was actively witnessing. These were things that could happen. And I think that's what that was. And because maybe, you know, we don't need to explain everything in these movies, right? That is, the filmmakers don't. But maybe because that was never a living spirit, her premonition had – it's almost like when you have a premonition, maybe that creature could sense her in an otherworldly sense and interact with her in a premonition, but doesn't mean that it brought her there. So I don't think so. That's my answer.
Gotcha.
That's my very overly elaborate answer. I thought about that a good bit too.
Yeah.
And what else I thought about, by the way, was that she basically went into the further.
Yep.
And encountered the Bride in Black from Insidious and Mary Shaw from Dead Silence.
Wow.
They all, like I said, James Wan has his style. He likes these characters. They all have big chins and big noses and are usually played by men. Usually, not always. But it's an interesting little pattern that happens. So, but he likes that look. It's a very powerful one, right? The pale face with the white to yellow eyes and the black shawl and black hair or a black surrounding somehow. It's pretty powerful.
And if you say the red lipstick demon looks like Darth Maul, we're going to fight.
I was going to say the red lipstick demon looks like Bill Wilkins.
Yeah.
That's no, the first first reference I get. Because I did see the first one.
Lipstick demon?
Yes.
I love that guy.
But the lipstick demon, right, he's bald and he has kind of long hair on the side of his head for someone who's bald. He has a big nose and he has yellow eyes. Yeah, and we first meet him in a corner and he's scarily pointing in the greatest jump scare in a decade, right, when he points to the kid in the further and the bird points to the bed. Well, when we meet Bill Wilkins in demonic form for the first time, he's bald. His hair is irregularly long on the sides and sticks out a little bit. He also has a big nose. They give him yellow demon eyes. He, like the man who can't breathe, uses an oxygen mask.
Yeah.
And he also has a scene where he comes out of the dark in the corner for a very, very effective jump scare. And I'm not saying any of this is negative criticism, by the way. Guillermo del Toro loves clockwork. Loves automatons, loves unhinging jaws. They're in three or four of his films, and then the show that he did. It's like, but I don't criticize that negatively, that he keeps using these concepts in slightly different ways. But it's interesting that Juan has his style, and that you can very clearly tell a Juan movie by a lot of these elements.
And what I haven't looked too much into Warrens as real people. A lot of people are saying they're hoaxes, whatever, but I'm thinking of them as like the fictional characters in these movies. And I think my favorite aspect about the Warrens, if you're looking at this movie as actually taking place and they know what they're doing, I love that the Warrens in their own home have a room where they store things that are evil to, like, keep them away from everybody else.
Right. And the one shot that we get of Annabelle in both of the Conjuring movies are better than the whole Annabelle movie.
Yes, yes. The one moment, the 10 seconds with Annabelle, I was like, oh, yeah.
Wait, are you saying it's kind of like they have a room that's kind of like Ghostbusters, where it's just a bunch of demons or something, and they're holding them like you know.
Right. Instead of the containment unit,
right.
It's just their menagerie of cursed items that they keep in a locked room.
So like, you know, charm box, those
like cabin in the woods.
Yeah, exactly.
Like which one is somebody going to touch? Yeah.
Exactly.
And you know what else? You made a reference, like people are calling it hoaxes, but we're just looking at them as fictional characters. Same analogy as the witch.
Yeah.
Wow. It, you know, like, oh, that didn't happen. It doesn't matter if it happened or not. It's a movie.
And
people get so upset.
I just love this. I love that they have a daughter, which I feel bad for her. I'd send her to boarding school. I really would. I'd be like, I don't want my daughter living in this house. But I just appreciate that these people take this evil on when they don't have to. And it's very much so like Elise and Tucker and Specs in the Insidious films. But
great characters. Oh, my God.
And I just like – I don't know. I like that there's heroes in horror. I feel like that's rare. And they're not victims. I kind of like that. And James Wan always finds good kids. Like his acting kids are good. And the little chimney sweeps in this movie are great.
Yeah, I mean, we see great actors in movies we discussed recently, like The Hallow, Honeymoon, and Willow Creek. But even when they're temporarily shifted kind of through circumstance into a heroic, or we'll just call it a survival role or a protective role, they're not heroes from the start. And like you said, yeah, that's unusual, right? Can you think of other movies that have heroes from the start? I mean, in a horror movie like that are effective? That's so unusual.
Yeah. Sigourney Weaver in Aliens, but she's kind of along for the ride.
Right, no, she became a hero of circumstance, but she grew up fast, and they had their – she was the second in command, and then the first in command died, and she just assumed her role.
Yeah, Ernest wasn't a hero immediately, and Ernest scared stupid.
Right, he grew into it and discovered Miak.
Pure Bulgarian Miak. Go ahead.
You go ahead, Robert. You haven't seen it, so I'm really curious to hear what you're going to ask or say.
No, I wasn't going to say anything. I've been watching the grouper video the whole time, so just let me know when you guys are...
He's been watching the grouper video and flinch-kicking Lazavath on the floor.
Yeah, oh, man, you should see these flinches. Lazavath is just... Oh, he's so scared, but it's not going to happen. Don't worry, buddy. I got you. He can't hear me.
There were some things in this movie, and it could just be, you know, like an honorarium or borrowing, or it could have truly from Poltergeist, or it could have truly been things recounted from the Enfield ghost case. But I thought it was interesting how in the beginning you had the moving chair that was harmless, remember? Yeah. And that was the first proper incident that we have that multiple people see that's harmless in Poltergeist. We have the menace of the tree outside, the use of storms, not that that's unusual or creepy trees. We have the flood or immersed scene with the dead coming from the water. That was in Poltergeist. You also have the children's room that gets locked off that has floating objects in it. That was very reminiscent of Poltergeist. And it was interesting that we even had a chair stacking sequence in the premonition scene where Patrick Wilson is killed, or where Ed Warren is killed. Then the paranormal team. There are a lot of things in here that are like Poltergeist. And it had me thinking, did Poltergeist emulate the Enfield ghost scenario? And I researched it, and it's not based on that. So I guess James Wan really liked the way that 1982, not 2015, Poltergeist was there. And again, this is not a negative criticism. It's just that I happen to notice all these things. And it's like he's taking the elements of Poltergeist and his other movies that he liked, particularly the Insidious movies, and then adding that to this Enfield ghost story with the Warrens. And he made this interesting amalgam.
Yeah. Just a big fun machine. And whoever did the doors on their home, the Enfield, or the people living there, I want to get whoever made those doors.
Those are some tough doors, aren't they?
Their basement door would prevent, like, a rhino.
In Game of Thrones, the Battle of the Bastards would have turned out so differently at the end if they had those doors.
Don't tell me. I haven't watched it yet.
Okay.
Don't run it.
I'm stopping there.
Ah!
Wait. So the demon, right? I guess I have one negative criticism of this movie, and it's a very, very small moment in the movie. But in the end, right, when Vera Farmiga, when Lorraine Warren is going to – when she realizes she knows the name of the demon, she goes finds it because that will help save them, right?
Yeah.
And all she does is walk in the room and say its name.
Yeah.
I mean, she says a few things. I know your name. I now have power over you.
I wouldn't even say that. I would just go, Valak. Hey, Rick.
But the moment she says – yeah, like, hey, Rick, yo, Valak. Val, and then it just poof, it disappears, and that's it.
Oh, dang it.
But so, like, here's the funny what if, right? Because that was a little anticlimactic, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then, like, what if she remembered, what if back when she was scribbling in her Bible, she looked at it then. She was like, something weird possessed me. That's very strange. So, and I get premonition. So I'm going to look at this. And she sees that it's Valak. Then she wouldn't even have had to leave the house. She'd just be like, oh my God, the name. I know the name, Valak.
Yeah. She goes, V-A, what does that spell? Valak? And then in the background, you hear, whoa!
Every time one of those like rings breaks off of the curtain, I'm like, it's not as strong as it was when it had one more ring. Why are there equal increments of the rings breaking? Like it should go bing, 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 bing. You know what I mean? It would not be that way.
Well, these are London drapes.
Right. Well, I mean, they were built by the same guy who did the doors.
Yeah.
He was a door maker / curtain ring smith.
Yeah, he was like the local guy.
And guys, I keep saying things and I keep defending, but really, I very much love this movie. I'm saying this to our listeners. I love this movie, but I love finding similarities. And that's all this is, except for Valak. That's a criticism.
Like, this may sound weird. Like, all right, let's say you and I, all three of us are huge Tampa Bay Rays fans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So every game we go to, we're excited. And we know every game we go to, there's going to be baseball played. But it's a different game each game. You know, different things happen, but there's the same kind of things. And we still love each game. I look at that as a lot of horror. Like, there's the same things going on, but there's different, you know, teams coming in. There's a rivalry. There's different characters, you know, different pitchers. So it's kind of like there's the same themes, but it's still like very fun to go watch.
Just because you've watched footage of a triple play in a historic baseball game doesn't mean that the next triple play you see 20 years later is like, ugh, eye roll, how lame.
Someone has seen it, show something new.
Oh, whatever, you struck three people out, seen it, next.
Yeah. Yeah, Mike Trout, whatever. You know, like, yeah, I mean, for me, this movie, and we were talking about Robert, you know, we spoiled it for you, but I do think these movies, you could sort of spoil a James Wan movie because it's more about, like, the ride. Like, he really – and we didn't tell you about a lot of different scenes in this movie. Right. It's just like a fun house. Like, I could tell you how a roller coaster works, and you could still be thrilled on it. Like,
the other thing is that we didn't go A to B to C to D.
Jumped all over.
Yeah. We jump so far all over that you could know all this by heart and it'll still shock the shit out of you when it happens.
Yeah, it's just fun. It's James Wan has fun with the audiences, and because of that, you know, his movies since 2004 have made over $900 million. Actually, it's probably $950 million now.
Well, he did Fast 7, right? Or
yeah, just as horror movies. So with Fast 7, they've made like $2.5 billion.
Damn.
But just as horror movies have made about $950 million. And that beats – I think he's the king of mainstream horror. And a lot of people shake their heads. But I don't think there's any other mainstream horror director right now or director that gets the audiences the way he does.
Well, yeah, not anymore.
I could give you an example. I'll bet that example only has like one or two very successful movies under their belts and that they aren't as different as James Wan's movies.
Yeah. I just think he – I don't know. I think he gets audiences. And you know, with Fast 7, he basically just directed what people wanted. And right. It was the highest grossing movies ever.
Yeah. That was a huge hit.
I hope he doesn't just give what he thinks people want for Aquaman.
See, I don't even know what I want. I thought Adrian Grenier from Entourage was going to be in it. But I think he likes the horror movies. I think you can tell the joy in his horror films. And
what do you like better, Insidious or Conjuring?
I'm Insidious.
Really?
Conjuring 1,000 times over.
I'm Elise, Tucker, Specs, Patrick Wilson in a cardigan and Rose Byrne gets slammed all over the place.
If I was going to watch a movie with someone who was a very critical cinephile, who I just met, right, but I'm picking the movie – or whether it's a date or a buddy, it doesn't matter. Or someone who likes really serious horror movies, I'm going to pick The Conjuring. If I'm with someone who wants something fun, I'm going to pick Insidious. They're very different to me, the nature of those movies.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. And I just love Elise. I love that she's like this 75-year-old ghost hunter woman, and she's the hero. And Insidious 3 has the crunchy leg kick scene.
Oh, my God.
Have you seen the crunchy leg kick scene, Robert?
No, I didn't see Insidious 3.
Okay, so it's fun. This girl has these casts on her legs, right? She gets possessed. She starts walking. She starts leg kicking her bedpost.
Mm-hmm. Like Tong Po did the pillar in Kickboxer.
With her cast, right? So she kicks her leg cast off, like Kickboxer style. Then she starts walking on her crunchy, broken legs. And as she's walking, it's like...
Oh, my God.
I was reeling.
Really?
And, like, it's the best.
Yeah, I didn't see that one yet. I didn't see that, and I didn't see Conjuring 2. I got to check. I got to wrap those out.
The best, but thankfully James Wan didn't direct or have a big hand in it, was Annabelle.
Of course, we
did that in episode 4, and we reamed it hard. But, you know, it's funny. You, Mark, in that article you wrote about James Wan, I saw you gave a quote from the Lights Out director, David Sandberg, who's currently developing Annabelle 2. And he, and I quote, said that Annabelle 2 will be the Godfather 2 of creepy doll movies.
And that's perfect because Annabelle's terrible. So it's like, like, all right, that's pretty easy.
Wow.
I just love that quote. It's just, it makes me scared to see it, but also want to see it.
So is there going to be like De Niro and Pacino? There's going to be like flashbacks of Annabelle the doll back like during the Depression. And then during the future, and they're going to do flashbacks with Annabelle younger and older.
Dude, and in the – no. Or we'll have someone playing younger Ed Warren where Patrick Wilson is older Ed Warren.
Oh.
Older Ed Warren is in the minority of the movie. Huh?
Oh.
Like in The Godfather.
Keep your friends close, but your dolls closer. I just hope that's the main quote.
Yeah, keep them dolls close.
You say
like someone's gonna wake up and in bed next to him is like
a doll's head.
Yeah, except it's the moose from Frozen.
Yeah. No, that's Sven.
Sven.
A doll's head.
As long
head,
as it's not
terrible.
Olaf. Oh, a doll's head would be scary. I would be scared to see that.
Next time I'm visiting St. Pete and John's there, we're gonna break into your house, Robert.
Okay. Here's the thing. I mean we're wrapping up, right? Because John's passing out right now.
I want to get one reaction. How do you guys feel about the use of the crooked man in The Conjuring 2?
It felt a little. I totally forgot about him until you talked about him.
Very entertaining when it happened, but very little. Forced?
Yeah, it was kind of Babadook-y.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah.
But very creepy. It was cool and neat to see when the dog transformed into the crooked. And I'm just like, what is happening?
Yeah, that was – I mean, I had fun with it. I just totally forgot about it. I don't want that.
I think Juan was getting a little crazy in a fun way.
Yeah.
It's like he was drunk when he directed that scene. He's like, but he magically, like, everyone was something on board. He's like, crooked man, the dog turns into the crooked man. Like, what? He's like, action.
No one will notice.
Okay. I had to get that out, though.
We can't let Lazarus pass out.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, guys, he's out. He's definitely out right now. I think we'll wrap this up now. I'll untie him. I'll get him out of here. But he will probably, maybe on the next episode, want to talk a little bit about The Conjuring 2 and The Witch, because I know he watched those movies. And, you know, since he didn't have any time to say anything because he's been tied to the floor, I mean, you know, he'll probably want to talk about it next episode.
You know what we should do? Next episode, the listener questions come from Lazavath about those movies.
Yeah. I'm down for that.
Because he just listened to this episode, so... tied up under the table.
Yeah, I'm going to untie him just so he can edit this and then release it. I don't feel like doing that. I'll host it, but I'm not editing.
And the next time you hear from Robert, he's going to be on our cult classic, which we'll probably record in the next year.
Yeah, sometime within the next year. But yeah, like we did with the horror movie and the romantic romance movie.
Zoe Deschanel is dating Bill Murray.
Oh, yeah. And then Mason Jar. With the Cthulhu or whatever it was. Yeah.
We made the crossbow. Frankenstein stitchwork horror.
The crossbow.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I can't wait to do one of those again. We're going to do a cult movie, so that'll be interesting. But, all right. Well, I guess that does it for this episode. I'm just going to plug sharkdropper.com. You can just go to that our website. You can see all the podcasts on there, movies, films, and flicks, among all the other ones we do. We do about 10 or 11 different podcasts now. So check that out. You can always... write to us, go to sharkdropper.com, and then you can click on the contact page. That'll go directly to our email, and just email us. If you have listener questions, just go ahead, shoot us an email, and we'll put it on the show, as long as it's not too misogynistic. But if it has a turtle in it,
right,
that's cool. That's like definitely cool.
Gamora, okay. Gamora,
no.
Know
the difference between those. Do you guys want to plug anything?
Movies, films, and flicks. Head to the website. Go to John's Horror Index. He has hundreds of horror reviews. You know, we're always putting up something. I just put up the best horror movies of this decade so far. We have a few. Oh, the Random Awards are coming out. That's our post next week, and our podcast. So just kind of pay attention to the site. Also, yeah, that's it.
Cool. Watch out for Dolph Lundgren, because Mark has breathed life back into the column that maybe started this website, right? The Bad Movie Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote my first Bad Movie Tuesday while on the set of Dual Survival in the Everglades.
Oh, shit.
Doesn't sound like you were paying a lot of attention to that movie.
Yeah. And it was the worst review I've ever written in my life, and it took me like 3 weeks to write. So we've come a long way.
Holy crap.
Is it the best, because then moviesfilmsandflicks.com had a post.
That's right.
Yeah, it helped it out. Right. Why not?
Don't watch Kindergarten Cop 2.
Yeah. I'm going to, but
no!
I'm not rushing to do it.
The idea of it is
Shark
better.
Lake. Watch Shark Lake instead.
I saw Shark Lake. I did not like Shark Lake.
It was terrible.
Yeah, it was.
He is the worst father ever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. No, not a fan, but I will watch Kindergarten Cop 2 just for the hell of it. All right, I'm literally kicking John now, and he's not moving, so I'm gonna try to get him out of this room. It's just way too hot in here. I'll breathe some life back into him. But for Mark, for John, I've been your host, Robert, and that's it for Movies, Films, and Flicks this week. We'll catch you next time.
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.